just as a sort of context for this sort of work, I mean, the obviously increasing mobility, increasing population density, population sizes, increasing contact between wildlife populations and people, for example, civet cats in southern China suddenly being eaten, brings the possibility through wet markets of contact between people and animals that haven't been in contact before, possibility of new emerging diseases. We also have developments in surveillance. So as well as the potential for new and faster spread of disease, we also have for increasing efforts in surveillance, mass media, Twitter. Exactly. I don't know. I think that didn't quite, wasn't quite up and going, at least not as broadly when flu started, but certainly one would imagine the next pandemic will have Twitter going crazy with all these different reports of where it is and what's going on. So there's a real need in developing tools, and my background is actually biostatistics, so I work in a modeling group and work collaboratively with modelers, so I suppose I'm moving in that direction, but we're an interdisciplinary group, so there are lots of different inputs into this. But the challenges of infectious disease modeling and analysis now mean that with all these increasing data sets, because there's more detailed data on populations and how they're spread, there's satellite data looking at different things, so vegetation cover, and things like that can be incorporated, information on temperature, so on. All these bits of information come forward, and with outbreaks in particular, there's demand for real-time data analysis. So analysis as the data is coming through, making sense of it, collating it, making sense of it, and giving the best possible estimates. In some ways, there's actually too much demand for real-time analysis to the extent that there has to be an appreciation of real-time uncertainty, as well as real-time estimates, that, you know, just demanding that there is an answer doesn't mean that one can be, a reliable one can be provided. An answer can be provided, but, you know, you want it in a way that's actually useful in the longer term. So all these things create challenges, but also opportunities for people who work in infectious disease modeling. So there's a need for new tools and new models to go with them. And so the MRC funded a center within our department, so Department for Infectious Disease Epidemiology, and we're this center for outbreak analysis and modeling. We were set up about 2 years ago, so had a bit of lead time on what has since been the pandemic, and we had a mission statement, because everybody needs a mission statement, and so it was to be an international resource and center of excellence for research on modeling and analysis of novel infections, and to undertake collaborative research. So it was to collaborate, it was to provide a resource both nationally and internationally to try and specifically to build increasing links with places like the CDC and the WHO and the Health Protection Agency here more locally, to try and increase understanding of the work that we do, increase understanding of the needs and expertise and sort of raw data that are being collected in these other places so that they can be brought together in the most productive collaboration and sort of sets of work. So if you've got a mission, you have to have objectives. So there's an outbreak analysis unit. So this was a central part of what was actually being built up, that there would be a rapid response capacity. In fact, the center is directed by Neil Ferguson, and I collaborated with him both in analyzing BSE and variant CJD back in 1996, and working like complete maniacs trying to give a rapid response with not much capacity, and again in 2001 with foot and mouth disease. And so what we did in those cases was divert resources, which we were supposed to be doing other things, to outbreak response. This was to set up capacity specifically for outbreak response. And obviously, a lot of other people then in the center and in the department become interested in doing the outbreak. But that there's continuity in people who are specifically tasked with carrying out that job. And there was also this collaborative long-term relationships, and the collaborative long-term relationship was seen as a priority, not just lip service, in that, as I'll show, we actually had somebody who was going to spend a lot of time in WHO. So a staff member of the center would spend a lot of time at WHO and really open doors and facilitate things, because while you can have missions and agreed goals, actually achieving those requires a lot of open communication and brokered trust between different people and different organizations. And so various research programs were going on, and this is a very group that involves a lot of PIs and lead researchers, just to show that. And so, as I mentioned, Neil Ferguson is the director of center, but then we have various researchers, and the one I want to draw attention to, Peter White, who's listed at the bottom, because he's actually, now he was originally at Imperial College, and now he is jointly employed by the Health Protection Agency and Imperial College. So he's mostly at HPA, but he does still have an appointment at Imperial College, so that also facilitates links across those organizations. And so as this is all sort of setting the scene for the pandemic then that was about to unfold. So and there were major research areas, and influenza was already one of them, including pandemic modeling and planning. So it was already in there as part of the research program, and one of the key goals is to, it was probably anticipated that it would be more likely to come from an Asian country than Mexico, but the methods are the same. And there, you know, one of my colleagues, Azargani, has considerable research looking at avian influenza and analyzing field programs, collecting data on that. So Neil Ferguson had undertaken pandemic modeling, looking at response plans, how antivirals might be most effectively distributed, not just to protect people in that country, but more globally. So this is our woman in Geneva. Maria had been hired in March of this year, and so from the 27th of April, she was in WHO until August. So she did come back for the occasional weekend, but she spent all her time there, and she was then in September. Something's happened when I've transferred over to this, that the fonts have all gotten bigger. So far there's nothing actually critical that's gone off the bottom, but I apologize if some of the spacing has gone wonky. So she was has spent most of her time in December. By the time it got to December, she was only spending 1 week out of the month there. But she spent a huge amount of time conveying information back and forth. And it was really critical to us as a center providing things that would be useful to WHO to know what their priority questions were and to be able to provide quick expert input into challenges that they faced, which arose in various settings. I mean, there's levels of disease and there's levels of perception of disease, and trying to distinguish those and prioritize very important. So one of the things that happened at the WHO was that there was an informal mathematical modeling network that was convened by Neil Ferguson convened by the WHO and led by Neil Ferguson in our group and Kathy Roth at the WHO. And so it was to bring together modelers for the real-time modeling of SARS, and it was coordinating this informal group. So it was bringing things together. There were a lot of telephone conversations, teleconferences in May and June as this group was convened, and there was even a face-to-face meeting in July. But it was trying to bring people together so that they could get the best possible input, encourage collaborations among the people that were there, and discuss the challenges that were being raised. So this is just to give you a feel of the range of people who were there. So there were people from academic institutions, WHO obviously, other key organizations like the European CDC and the National Institute of Health, and also national public health agencies from various countries, including Asia and South America. So it was trying to bring together people from really a broad breadth to this network. And so one of the key purposes of this was not only to bring together expert advice, but to also have a secure environment in which to discuss pre-publication results. so that the results of the work were getting assimilated to an extent at the pre-publication level. So it was to look at describing and predicting the impact and behavior of the pandemic. They wanted these analyses suitable for sort of public consumption as well as to go to policymakers. But there was, of course, a need for confidentiality. If you're going to ask people to share results that are pre-publication, which may be pre-publication and polished, or pre-publication and a first look at things or preliminary data, there's a need for confidentiality. So there was an undertaking that there would be confidentiality in the discussions that were presented, and also a need for people not to be then giving media statements as a WHO advisor, giving their personal opinions. So while there was no restriction on people discussing the pandemic themselves from their own point of view, there was a need for there to be able to have discussions within the network that then would not be presented, and to be careful that people weren't presenting their own views as being somehow sanctioned and or accepted by WHO when they weren't.
Whoa.
Okay. I think this one was just about, in collaboration with WHO, how this facilitated two-way communication, as well as communication between the different groups, the different representatives that have been brought in here. So I wanted in this talk to give examples of three of the collaborations that were built during the epidemic, or built or developed during the epidemic, and the output of those. So this is a paper that developed very, very quickly indeed. It actually went in 2 weeks from our initial meeting, submitted the paper a week later, and it was published a week after that. So it went incredibly quickly. A huge number of people were involved, and so this is we got the name of the WHO Rapid Pandemic Assessment Collaboration. There are many different collaboration labels if you look at the various pandemic papers that are out. So it had people from the MRC Center, from Imperial, genetics collaborators in Edinburgh and Oxford. We had five people who were collaborators from Mexico, and that was a collaboration that was facilitated by WHO, who are also represented here. And they were in Veracruz, which is one of the very affected areas early on, and Mexico City. So it was an international collaboration. Luckily, we found that just by chance, we had people in our group who were fluent in Spanish, so that helped as well, who were, you know, translating various things that we were finding on the web. And so in this, we were able to look at, one of the things was to look at where, at this early stage of late April, early May, the global spread of the epidemic. And so what we looked at was the pattern of air travel. So we already had pre-existing data on air travel between different airports, and so we could focus here specifically on air traffic in and out of Mexico, and the number of confirmed cases by location. And the number of confirmed cases we either plotted here by country, or we had more detail if they were in the US or Canada. But we were able to show that there was a close correlation between the amount of air traffic between Mexico and these countries and the number of confirmed cases that there had been. And on that basis, we were able to perform a back calculation, making an estimate of how many days tourists had spent in Mexico. Because in a sense, you can think of tourists as going and sampling the risk that's going on in Mexico. And so if you know how many days they've spent in Mexico and what proportion of them became infected, you can then work backwards to estimate how many infections would have been sort of domestically in Mexico. And I give you one line here because of the font, but it's over on the order of 20 to 30,000 were some of the estimates that came through. And then, and that could be based on just present. We did it two ways. One of them was an interval censored model, and that's where we said, okay, we think the number of infections that happened in Mexico was somewhere between the number of groups affected. So if a family traveled together and they all got infected, We saw it as interval censored between one infection happened in Mexico and all of them happened in Mexico, because you don't know how much transmission happened within tourist groups. So we did an estimate that way with interval censoring. We also did estimates just based on presence or absence of confirmed influenza in a country and how much air travel it had links to Mexico. So a key collaboration, as I mentioned, we even have a joint staff member, was with the HPA, and Peter White is the head of the Modeling and Economics Unit within the Center for Infections, and they have 16 staff, and they have close links with a number of people, so I didn't want to give you the impression Imperial College were the only people with building up these various collaborations. So the MRC Biostatistics Unit is one, and various universities. So Health Protection Agency and their staff have been very proactive in setting up collaborations with various groups. And obviously there's HPA Portendown as well that's involved, and Health Protection Scotland, because of the interesting relationships between different agencies in the different parts of the UK. And so pandemic influenza planning already was high on the agenda before the pandemic, and there are various government committees. There's SPI, the pandemic, Scientific Pandemic Influenza Advisory Group, SPI-M, which is the modeling subgroup, and SAGE, which is Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. There is actually a SAGE at the WHO as well, which is a group of experts. So SAGE is obviously is quite appealing as an acronym. But there was that was the UK SAGE, and it had links directly to the Chief Scientific Advisor, so direct into government. And they were involved in having experts come in and present information to them. Reports were presented, analyzing the data as it came through, describing it, and drawing what conclusions could be there. This paper, which is currently published in PLOS Currents, it's under review with a more traditional journal, but it is available publicly at PLOS Currents, which is an initiative to bring influenza papers out to public accessibility as fast as quickly as possible. So this paper, which is, as you can see, a collaborative effort between the HPA, Health Protection Scotland, and the MRC Centre at Imperial, with the London School and Strathclyde being additional affiliations of a couple of people, John Edmonds being a key one there. So this paper actually presents work that is, so it's a collaborative paper, but it actually represents work that to some extent was developed in parallel. Because while there was an initial report that went forward, which was jointly produced between Peter White with his HPA hat on and Neil Ferguson from Imperial, they were specifically asked that there should be separate and independent analyses undertaken from the MRC Center and from HPA. And so from that point then, separate analyses were undertaken, often answering the same sorts of questions. But that said, the UK data that we were using was typically data that had been collected by HPA or related agencies. So there was always that link. But then once it went from the original data and the design onto how it was analyzed, and that was done in parallel, and then at a later stage, then these were sort of brought together and presented. And you can see with the stars that represent the joint first authors and the crosses that represent the joint corresponding authors, there's sort of a parallel balance being struck between the different groups. So one of the things that was done in this paper was to look at an epidemic tree reconstruction. So to try and take Willinga and Tunis was a method for estimating the reproduction number. That's how a measure of how the disease spreads. So it's an average new cases per current case. So you can think of it as, so if it's greater than one, you'll have case numbers increasing. If it's less than one, you'll have an epidemic that's ebbing. So it was trying to get an estimate of the reproduction number over time. And there are different ways you can do that, more or less parametrically. And you can incorporate contact pairs from tracing. So to the extent that it was possible, you'd have someone say, oh, yes, I have flu, and I was in touch with this person who had flu. And in the very early stages of an epidemic, that is more feasible in cases. Not always possible, but it is feasible. And then people had transmission within households, transmission at schools, and then people who'd been to the U.S. or Mexico typically assumed that they would have gotten infected there. So then you can create lovely trees of how these epidemics spread. So this is represents the individual. So Mexico is represented by the green square at the top, and then the U.S., the blue square, and then transmission beyond it. So the other colors represent sort of individual schools or contact locations, and you can sort of analyze the spread as it's going forward. So if you think of the reproduction number, that will be a description of how many links you have from one individual, how many they typically spread out to as the epidemic is unfolding. And this gives you the estimates over time. So it was found that there was some indication that the rate of transmission, the reproduction number, was sort of wobbling up and down over time. So these are two different methods presenting estimates over different time periods, one for England and Wales and one for Scotland. And so you can see that by the sort of late May and June onwards, it was well above one, which of course is the key feature. Do you have ongoing transmission? Obviously, if you're getting, you could see case numbers go up or down depending on travel patterns to Mexico if all the infections were happening there. But this is trying to get a handle on what was actually happening within the UK and how much transmission there was. And so these school epidemics were quite influential in that. And finally, just to present so these things were going on in parallel. Described that we had a large number of people working within the MRC Center. At the very early stage, within the first 2 weeks of working on it, I mentioned that we had the first paper which came out in Science. At that point, Simon Cauchemez had already gone to the U.S. He stayed there initially for 6 weeks at the CDC, working there. And he was an interesting, I don't think he'd been to the CDC, at least not very much before then, and was presented with an interesting tradition there, which is some of the people in the CDC wear uniforms. So he had somebody who was basically a general show up at his little cubicle and tell him that he had to produce a certain report by, you know, sort of midday today. So quite an interesting culture shock. And so Mark Lipsitch from Harvard was also there at the same time. So they were sort of working together in next door cubicles, trying to give advice. They do have lots of cubicles at the CDC. and so the work that Simon Cashman, I then went and spent some time in two different trips at the CDC, and so again trying to foster that relationship. And we worked quite well with both the influenza people and the epidemiology people to make best use of the data that they had. They were in a situation of having to produce reports to their director every morning as sort of start of the day. And because of the way that the states report the states weren't reporting until the late afternoon. So they were having to get, and were not keen on moving that. So they were getting about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they would get all the reports from the states, and then they were producing analyses and trying to make them interesting and have a different theme from the previous day, rather than purely just, and this estimate is now 4.31 instead of 4.32, had an incredible challenge. So, and a huge number of people were there. They were dealing with the epidemiology, logistics, risk assessment, communication, all these different things. It was quite extraordinary to visit. And we're using their sort of incident facilities to try and do this. And one of the things with that, having gone to see it, is that they have, once you go into that, it's what I understand to be the model from the military, which is that you cease to have so much an individual identity as you represent your particular function. So you might be logistics, and they actually just have a little label over it, like logistics, or you might be the statistician or the epidemiologist. And so you sort of, now that's your role. And so in some sense, it doesn't matter which particular epidemiologist is there. It's just that they know that that role is filled, and so immediately where to go to. So very interesting as a setting. And so the data set that we had, one of the data sets that we had access to that we, analyzed here. Sorry, we seem to not have made the transition to Mac very well. Okay, this is 600 household contacts of confirmed cases. And so what the interesting graph here shows is the secondary attack rate as a function of household size. So the percentage of people in a household, those contacts of an initial case that became infected, the percentage decreases as the household size gets bigger. And we also show as a function the proportion of children as a function of household size. So as household sizes get bigger, not surprisingly, the proportion that are children increases. But also, you see a drop in the secondary attack rate. And that was a pattern that had previously already been described, even specifically in influenza. And just the contact patterns within different sorts of households do change. So we were able to estimate from that the serial interval, or the time, so from, think of it just as being, so from case to case. And so this shows distribution. You can either look at the observed time between an index case, that's the one that started the study in a particular household, and onsets in their contacts. And you see that some of them actually had contacts that came down the same day. So there was 0 days between the index case and the contact. Now, then you need to make a decision when you're analyzing this of how you're going to count those. Do they actually count as a very speedy transmission, or do they count as most likely a co-primary infection, so another introduction into the house? And so what we chose to do here is to exclude the infections that also happened on day zero, and allow in a model for tertiary infections, because you have to allow for the possibility as you get out to 7, or even the follow-up was actually 2 weeks, by the time you're getting out to the very large number of days from the initial onset of disease, that it's less likely that that's a direct transmission from your index case. It could be onward transmission within the house, so a transmission chain, or of course there's always a possibility that if somebody's in a setting where they could have gotten an infection in the first place, there can be another introduction. So allowing for that, we get a mean of about 2.6 days and a standard deviation of about 1.3 for the serial interval. And just building on this, this is giving you examples of the collaboration, and taking that to sort of perhaps its logical conclusion, it may be pushed even further, is this collaborating swine influenza initiative, which was collaborative in its funding. It was an initiative by the BBSRC, MRC, Wellcome Trust, and DEFRA, and it also brought together the largest group of collaborating institutions that I've ever dealt with in a single sort of project. So the initiative was to bring together groups that had been identified as being most relevant, and I'm not sure how that, my impression was that the funders were actually, it was their initiative to choose people who were invited to this, and then the goal was to build a proposal that involved everybody. So that's going forward, organized by University of Cambridge and the Veterinary Laboratories Agency. And another key collaborative project I haven't had time to introduce about is with the Chinese CDC. So we're now collaborating with them, looking at their influenza data. And that is, I think, a result of earlier links that Neil Ferguson had been building up with the Chinese CDC. I mean, these work best if they're built on a sort of, you know, an ongoing level of collaboration, or at least interest in these organizations, because otherwise it gets, well, one, it's overwhelming, and two, it's hard to be as productive if suddenly people are just phoned up from all over the place, suddenly wanting to collaborate when something, you know, overwhelming to resources is going on. So I hope I've given you a flavor for the different things that we looked at. I apologize for the translation of the fonts, but hopefully you got a flavor for it. Thank you.